Somehow I feel this voice recorder should be bigger, because I feel a bit of a prat just fiddling with something so tiny and not understanding. Okay, so welcome everybody. This is the second philosophy talk of the time. This is Peter Wolfendale, Dr. Peter Wolfendale, from effectively the University of Warwick, but also an independent scholar. He got his PhD from Warwick Philosophy in 2011 on ultimately questions to do with ontology and logic, I would say, but it became, as such PhDs do, to revolve around the work of Martin Heidegger. In the end, it was about so much more, I always thought, in a certain way, but Heidegger became somehow the hero.
Not the hero, but the perhaps the dragon that was supposed to be slain, I don't know.
Well, this is excellent, but in any case, questions of ontology, what being is and what rationality are, have always been a concern to me. It's one of the central figures of a movement around this speculative realism movement and so on, and he's worked a lot on things like Brandon, McDowell, and so on, some of you will know from me in the past and other places. But next, I'll just let this person around, and let him speak himself. So the title of the talk is The Passing of the Wave, Political Agency Between Rational Subjectivity and Phenomenal Self. Thank you.
Okay, so the parting of the ways, the crucial two parts that are being separated here, rational subjectivity and phenomenal self. Right. So, we must learn to dissociate subjectivity from selfhood and realise that a selfhood and following the act, the distillation of the subjectivity of reason, and reason itself enjoins the destitution of selfhood. This is a quote taken from a paper by Ray Brassier, in which, while championing the important insight of Thomas Metzinger's theory of phenomenal self-consciousness, while Brassier champions the important insight of Thomas Metzinger's theory of phenomenal self-consciousness, that there is no such thing as self, he nevertheless criticises Metzinger for failing to distinguish this from what Wilfred Sellers, following Kant and Hegel, would call rational self-consciousness, or that there are nevertheless such things as subjects. In essence, he takes Metzinger's everlasting contribution to be finally allowing us to clearly distinguish between phenomenal selfhood and rational self-consciousness. The aim of the current paper is to explore this distinction further by showing how Metzinger's theory of phenomenal consciousness can be integrated into a broadly Salazian theory of rational consciousness, along with some of the consequences of doing so. This is made possible by the fact that both theories are forms of functional. They aim to describe how a causal system would have to be configured in order to be conscious, and they aim to do this independently of the particular material substrate within which this system would have to be instantiated. So this means that they apply both to the biological forms of consciousness that have evolved on Earth and to the technological forms of consciousness that we may one day construct. So this is meant to be loosely incorporated as themes from artificial intelligence. Right. Now, the divergence between Metzinger and Sellers' approaches comes at a difference in emphasis regarding the two aspects of the traditional notion of subjectivity: awareness and agency. Metzinger provides a functional description of consciousness as a form of information processing, supplementing it with a functional description of self-consciousness that, in presenting it as a modification of this sort of information processing, turns the self into so much informational mist, letting its substance evaporate under our theoretical gaze. It does this by understanding the way a system becomes aware of both its world and itself in terms of the way it represents them, that representation. Now, what I want to show is that a Salazian functional description of consciousness can be built on top of this account of information processing, but that this involves understanding the way a system becomes an agent capable of undertaking theoretical commitments about its world and practical commitments about how it will act within it in terms of its responsibility for these commitments. This lets us... I'll repeat the last sentence. I will show that a Salazian functional description of consciousness can be built on top of this accounting information process, but that this involves understanding the way a system becomes an agent capable of undertaking theoretical and practical commitments in terms of its responsibility for these commitments. This lets us see the subject as the stubborn locus of responsibility that refuses to sublimate along with itself. It amounts to a form of normative mindedness rather than experiential mindedness, though these two notions will be fundamentally connected at the end. First of all, Messina has described one of the characters of consciousness. Right. So, before I can present Messina's theory, it's first necessary to say something about explanation. It's entirely possible to hold that nature is composed of a single metaphysical plane, that there is a single mode of individuation of entities upon this plane, and only one form of causation between these entities, while nevertheless admitting that there are many different forms of explanation that can be applied to it. To put this in the form of a slogan, ontological univocity is compatible with explanatory univocity. The reason I'm making this claim up front is because I want to differentiate myself and Messina and Sellers from philosophers like Heidegger and Sartre, who insist that the only way to make sense of our understanding of ourselves and others is in terms of an ontological distinction between kinds of being, between Dasein and non-Dasein, or between the for itself and the in itself. Fundamentally, I think, and Messina and Sellers think that we can be understood as causal systems in precisely the same way as everything else. The difference is that the difference comes in the way in which we explain the behaviour of those causal systems. So I'm not going to say anything more about non-causal forms of explanation, like, for instance, explanation of mathematical theories. The salient fact for the present enterprise is that we describe causal systems by applying what I call explanatory schema, which facilitate the development of predictions about the way they behave under various possible conditions. This is to say that it provides us with more or less general ways of organising counterfactual reasoning about these possibilities, thereby enabling us to draw specific conclusions about how they would behave in any given set of circumstances. I try to draw the distinction between an explanatory schema and a law from which you derive predictions. So a good example would be the idea of natural selection. Karl Popper very famously argued that the idea of natural selection isn't a scientific law that could be falsified. Because if you try and turn it into such a law, what survives, you end up with a kind of tautology. The importance of the idea of natural selection is rather that it gives us a way of organising our understanding of the causal factors involved in the genesis of the phenomenon. And that means that form of organisation can be used in different ways. So you can have competing evolutionary explanations of the same thing. You know, the schema doesn't give you a prediction directly, it gives you a way of thinking about and developing a prediction. Right. Now, on to the actual kind of schema I'm interested in, which is the functional schema. A functional schema enables us to develop predictions by treating a system on analogy with practical reasoning. This works by allowing us to treat its parts as means in relation to the whole as an end. This lets us describe the causal role of the parts in terms of success and failure, and thereby to organise our reasoning about the causal relationships between them in terms of how that failure cascades throughout the system. So for example, the way that the narrowing of the aortic valve leads to heart failure, and thus the circulatory collapse and ultimately death. The explanatory power of a functional schema lies in its introduction of the possibility of malfunction. Now, Messina's theory provides us with three distinct types of functional schema. A schema for unconscious drives, conscious systems, and self-conscious systems. Now, these are three different loose functional structures. Firstly, unconscious drives are causal systems that take variable inputs and produce systematically correlated outputs. The drive schema enables us to understand the systematic correlation between these inputs and outputs which I'll call sensation and behaviour, in terms of a single goal state that the system aims at. In essence, we treat sensation as information about the environment that is processed in determining how to behaviourally adjust that environment in line with the goal state. However, there need be nothing like a representation of that goal state within the system. Nor need this information involve any kind of internal distinction between the system and its environment. These features emerge at the level of the consciousness schema and the self-consciousness schema, respectively. The important point is that we can interpret a single system as containing a multiplicity of drives without thereby unifying these drives under a single end. In this case, we see the causal roles of the various drives as either converging or conflicting with one another in the production of overall behaviour, potentially communicating with one another, but never prioritising the various goal states through some kind of unified information processing activity. Just a war of all against all, a kind of Nietzschean fashion. It's the move to the consciousness schema that provides the representational element necessary to unify disparate drives. This is because it deploys a representational schema and allows us to extend the functional schema through enabling us to develop predictions by treating a system through analogy with theoretical reasoning rather than just practical reasoning. This works by allowing us to treat its internal states as representing external states of its environment, and thereby to organise our reasoning about the causal relations between them in terms of the way they contribute to the success or failure of system's functionality. So the explanatory power of a representational schema lies in the tradition of the possibility of misrepresentation as a reason for malfunction. Right. According to Metzinger, a conscious system is one that possesses what he calls a phenomenal world model, or PWM. This is a functional subsystem that combines information from its various drives into a single store that is globally available to all those drives simultaneously. This sharing ties them together into a unified processing system with something like a common information format. This common information format gives us the purchase we need to interpret the model as an articulated representation of the world as a whole, with discrete parts corresponding to the things within the environment. This is what underwrites Metzinger's claim that there's a what he calls a minimal neurological correlate for any distinct representation present in the phenomenal consciousness. He believes that for anything which is discriminable, which can be discriminated within my consciousness, there is a minimal neural correlate of. There is some selection of neural subsystems which correspond to that discriminable entity. It's also what lets us represent the whole model as a representation of the present, insofar as different rates of information flow must all be integrated within a single window of process. So the fact that you've got this shared store of information which all the drives can access, even if those drives are running at different rates, is what provides us with a single consciousness of the present moment. The final element of this consciousness is what Metzinger calls transparency, which means that the system must be functionally unable to represent to itself the possibility of global misrepresentation. Some of the elements of the model may become opaque, to a degree, by incorporating representations of their own functional structure, and thereby the possibility of malfunction, but this must never extend to the functional structure of the model as a whole. That's a bit of a mouthful, I'm sorry about that. Basically, this metaphor of transparency sometimes appears a bit counterintuitive to people. What it means is, for Metzinger, our representation of the world is like kind of a plate of glass. It's presented to us as if we're in direct contact with the world, despite the fact that there's all this neural machinery underlying the generation of this representation. So we don't see the neural machinery, it's invisible, we just see through it. It becomes opaque when we start seeing the functional stuff that's going on to generate the representation. So an example would be like an optical illusion. where it becomes kind of apparent to us that there's something going on in their visual system rather than something to do with the world. Now Messinger's point about transparency is just that that can't happen global. There can't be a kind of global awareness of the functional system. Opaqueness can only happen local. Right. Messinger essentially thinks that conscious systems have an ongoing dynamic simulation of the world, which they're structurally unable to recognise as a simulation. That's what transparency is, basically. He sometimes refers to this as a state of online dreaming. Some might be tempted to oppose this to some recent work on embodied cognition, which I don't know if anybody's familiar with, but I'll explain it a bit. This idea of embodied cognition emphasises the extent to which our representation of the world is not self-sufficient. So it tries to attack the idea that we have a complete representation of the world contained within our heads, and we use that representation in all of our actions in it. Rather, it tries to present ways in which the actual embeddedness of ourselves as agents within the world is required in order for that representation of the world to function. What I want to say is that there's no real opposition here. All the phenomenal world model requires is a minimal dynamic unit, the elements of which can be threadbare in the absence of regular updates in the state of the environment. And this is what happens in offline dreams. So in a dream as we normally think about it, where we aren't aware of the fact that actually there's an immense poverty of detail. Right? If you go through a wood in your dreams, the trees don't have a given number of leaves, they don't have particular determinate shades of colour, there's a whole bunch of phenomenal detail which just isn't there, but you're not aware of that absence of detail. What Messinger means when he calls consciousness an online dream is that basically our representation of the world has that same minimal dynamic unity in which we're not aware of the fact that it isn't completely full of detail, but rather it's just dynamically updated on the fly through actual encounters with things that we don't have in offline dreams. So what this means is that for many things we actually use our environment as a store of information about itself that can be dynamically accessed by interacting with it. And this means that the process of simulation can be extended even if its minimal dynamic unity is localised in the brain. So, self-consciousness. The self-consciousness schema moves beyond mere unification by introducing a distinction within the phenomenal world model between the system itself and all other aspects of its environment. This constitutes a further subsystem, which he calls the phenomenal self model, or PSM. The function of this subsystem is to move beyond unitary sensory processing, facilitated by the world model, to a unitary behavioural processing, which it achieves principally by enabling the system to represent not just the goal states it can achieve, but also its capabilities for achievement. Messinger is very explicit that these self models can come in various degrees of complexity. He thinks all kinds of animals have them, not all of them, but he believes that there are three basic functional elements of these insofar as they come to human self-consciousness. And these are ownership, which is the incorporation of elements of the world model within the self model, the identification of certain things within the world as belonging to the self. Location, which is the perspective of the self model within the world model. And agency, and this is the recognition of events within the world as being behaviour that's produced by the self. Each of these different elements can fail in its own ways, unless they can be pulled apart. So Messinger uses a lot of interesting examples from cognitive psychology, a lot to do with pathologies to show how it's been put apart. So two like interesting examples are body dysmorphia, in which ownership fails, where people come to think that aspects of their body don't belong to them. Their representations of what constitutes them actually malfunctions. Another example is there are interesting pathologies where people can start identifying things that happen in the world as being caused by them. They feel as if they're responsible for things that they have absolutely. So, you know, they feel as if when it rains, it's them who are making things rain. Sort of like a fake omniscience, omnipotence. Metzinger also identifies a more advanced functional element, which is characteristic of what he thinks of as higher states of human self-consciousness. This is what he calls attentional agency. And this is just control of sensory input and processing. So being able to exercise some control over what information you focus on within the world model. Right. The ego system. Here we get the payoff point. Now, Metzinger calls the system self-representation, the ego. This is the informational content of the phenomenal self model at any given time, as opposed to the functional role that that self model plays across all time. So the human ego contains various forms of information about this qua corporate system, ranging from more or less innate forms of bodily information, such as like bodily position, integrity, whether you're in pain or you've lost part of your body, and possible action, to more or less acquired forms of cultural information about our social relationships, statuses, and possible ways of negotiating social terrain. It also includes mnemonic information, converting the window of the present into what he calls a temporal tunnel, by enabling us to retain and recall our own history and to simulate possible futures. So all in all, taken together, this is what Metzinger calls the ego tunnel. It's the name of one of his books, and it's really good, I recommend it. It's the integration of all these forms of complex information that turns their self-representation from something like a simple map of the body into a complex personality. Now, once all this is bear in mind, Metzinger's argument that there are no such things as cells is fairly simple. The phenomenal self model's functional unity is not persistent. Any aspect of it, including the whole thing, can be switched off at any time. He gives various examples of how the different particular parts of it can be switched off, but the most pertinent one is sleep. When you sleep, your self model switches off. You are no longer representing yourself as a self. This means that any persistence of the self between activations must reside in the content of the model, or in the identity of the ego. Metzinger then simply points out there are no criteria of identity for individuated egos corresponding to the intuitive self-understanding involved in it. So, insofar as the phenomenal self model is part of the world model, it's possible for it to misrepresent things in just the way that the world model. It can fail to adequately represent the contours of the body, the historical episodes it's been involved in, or its capacity for action. However, the phenomenal continuity of ownership that it generates, the sense of being the same person across time, can't misrepresent, because there is strictly no unity to represent independent of its own function of unifying. The informational facets of personality that tracks, bodily, cultural, mnemonic, etc., can all vary independently of one another, making any criteria for binding them together more or less arbitrary. Now, this again seems fairly counterintuitive, given most of our fairly functional experiences of being similar personalities over time. It becomes a bit more real once you get into the more kind of like science fiction examples of the possibility of things like radical neurosurgery, or being able to upload the content of your brain and copy it into the body. The example that always gets me is the idea that someone could take me, perform radical neurosurgery on me, and systematically transform most of the things that I consider to make me. They could change my beliefs, my desires, my agendas, my tastes. They could even radically alter memory, you know, keeping some intact but completely, you know, making various fantasies. They could turn me into a kind of Manchurian candidate. But they could, at the same time, maintain that sense of phenomenal continuity. This new Manchurian Pete could still be perfectly convinced that he is continuous with me, despite the fact that everything that I consider to be important about me would be different. Anyway, we'll dwell on that more. Now, I'm now going to do my best to briefly sketch the way Metzinger's account can be extended by supplementing it with what I'll call Salazian rational schema. The realization of this rational schema is the introduction of a distinction between two types of informational unit, sentential and non-sentential. This produces a functional distinction between four types of information processes, based on how we pair those inputs and outputs. Perception, non-sentential input to sentential input. Action, sentential input to non-sentential input. Inference, sentential to sentential. And coping, non-sentential to non-sentential. I'll provide some examples of this so it makes more sense. Now, the details of the rational schema are how we connect various subsystems capable of performing these different kinds of processing to form a system whose functioning is no longer merely analogous to reasoning, as we saw in the functional schema and the representational schema, but which actually is reasoning. I'm not going to attempt to provide all these details, partly because I haven't got them all worked out, but instead I want to show how the issue of responsibility turns up within this kind of functionalist story. The Salazian position is that a system is only reasoning once it's keeping track of relations between sentences. And being in this position involves these syntactic units playing a very particular role within its functional informational economy. See, we can program computers to process sentential inputs and sentential outputs. So we can program computers to produce trivial mathematical deductions, or chess and mathematical proofs. And we can equally train parrots to produce sentential outputs, like saying, this is red, in response to non-sentential inputs, like the perceptual, the sensory experience of a red object. And we can train dogs to produce non-sentential outputs, for instance, fetching a stick, in response to appropriate sentential inputs, like fetch the stick boy. However, a rational agent capable of grasping the meaning of those sentences must be able to do all three of these things, and it must be able to do them in a way which connects them up properly. Sentences are syntactic units capable of playing all three roles within the same system. A state that can be observed, a state that can be inferred and used to, inferred from and used to infer another state, and a state that can be brought back. The system needn't be able to process every sentence in all three ways. So, I can't observe several neutrinos that just passed through me. I personally can't derive the truth of the claim that the continuum hypothesis is independent of ZF set theory from the ZF axiom. And I certainly can't bring about the truth of Betelgeuse has gone supernova. But I must be able to process some set of sentences in all three ways, and be able to process some sentence-sentence transitions for every sentence. I must be able to understand. Sorry, I'm saying it a different way. The semantic content of a sentence, its meaning, is the role that it plays within this functional economy of perception, action, and inference. But it's the inferential role that ties this together. It's the understanding of how the sentence stands in relation to other sentences. And that holds open the possibility that any sentence can be related to both perception and action. So for instance, if I understand that P implies Q, even though I might not be able to perceive that Q is the case, I can take it to be true by perceiving it appears to be. And similarly, although I can't directly make it to be true, I can make it appear by making people appear. It's this capacity for inference that transforms sensation and behaviour, as we saw in the consciousness schema, into perception and action. Now, the crucial thing about this capacity for inference is that it requires the ability to dynamically track one's theoretical and practical commitments. The sentences that one's committed to, the sentences that one takes to be true and that one intends to make true. So, or put another way, to reliably keep score of the claims one is responsible for justifying and the aims one is responsible for achieving. This involves the ability to dynamically update one's commitment by working out the consequences of existing ones and revising them on the basis of incompatibility between these consequences and newly acquired commitments. So I have to be able by acquiring new commitments in perception, for instance, ditch ones that are incompatible with them that I'm already storing, and to work out consequences of them that I might not yet have come across in the world of it. Now, I'm going to call the functional subsystem that carries out the dynamic tracking and dynamic updating the rational subject model. This subsystem, in turn, requires a capacity to dynamically track a broader space of possible positions than the one it occupies. So, we need to not just be able to keep track of the actual position we occupy within this sort of inferential space in terms of which commitments we do have, we also need to be able to understand what it would be to occupy different positions, because we are going to change our position as we dynamically update. I'll call this functional subsystem, the functional subsystem responsible for doing this, the inferential space model. These two subsystems are essentially inseparable, insofar as they are two parts of the same dynamic process, but they exist in tension insofar as the inferential space model must have the capacity to simulate other subject positions fully. A good example of this is where our ability to play devil's advocate with ourselves. What we essentially do there is to generate another consistent set of commitments opposed to our own, with which to start. The thing that functionally distinguishes our rational subject model from this kind of simulated subject is its reliability in translating its commitments into action. So, no matter how much we play devil's advocate, and no matter how much we understand what it would be to be in that space, that part of the commitment space, that simulated subject doesn't actually use our body to do things. It's not an agent. Something that could never act upon its commitments can never count as responsible for anything. It's in this sense that rational subjectivity is inseparable from agency. Now, I'm going to call this functional complex of the subject model and the inferential space model the core reasoning system, or CRS. The crucial fact about this reasoning system is that it needn't be self-sufficient any more than the world model. It needs a minimal functional unity, but it can effectively store information in other internal subsystems, including what Metzinger describes as the world model, and even in external environmental features, including, extended cognition would have it. But it can also store information within other rational systems and the larger social systems that they constitute. So our understanding can actually depend upon the understanding of others. A rational system need not have a static core of sentences that it tracks and updates, as long as it can dynamically call up commitments and inferential relations between them on the fly. We can thus be phenomenal consciousnesses that cope with their environment by efficiently processing sensory inputs into behavioural outputs without the need for reasoning, and nevertheless count as rational consciousnesses that perceive and act, as long as we have the capacity to channel this sort of processing through reasoning, through what I've called the core reasoning system. This is a functional essence of Kant's idea that rational consciousness is dependent upon the possibility of rational self-consciousness. I'm only conscious of something for Kant insofar as it can be appended to the I think, which just means insofar as I can take responsibility for it as mine, or insofar as it can become an explicit commitment that can be integrated into the other commitments that are tracked by my subject model. The question is now to what extent Messinger's problem for phenomenal selfhood can be repeated for rational subjects. Although the account just provided places certain constraints on what can possibly count as a rational subject, so this table can't count as a rational subject because it can't track what it's responsible for, these constraints still don't amount to sufficient conditions of individuation. So the rough account of rational agency that's been provided by the Savardian account provides necessary conditions for subjective individuation, but not sufficient conditions. There's no natural way of dividing up continuities and commitments and capacities into unique subjects any more than there is a natural way of dividing up continuities and personality into unique selves. However, there cannot be rational consciousness of any kind without the possibility of rational self-consciousness. This is the fundamentally Kantian idea I just glossed over. And this means that it's a functional requirement, or a transcendental requirement in fact, that we have some way of individuating subjects, even if it does not demand a particular way of individuating them. The crucial point is that whereas we can contrast the non-representational character of phenomenal continuity to the representational character of other aspects of the phenomenal self model, so that was the difference between the sense of being the same person that's generated by the model versus its representation of things like body position or integrity. That same sort of contrast isn't available between the commitments that are tracked by the rational subject model and the subjective continuity that this tracking presupposes. This is because the former are normative statuses that are socially conferred by participation in the game of giving and asking for reasons. So being committed to either justifying a particular belief or to acting on a particular desire or commitment is something which can't be understood outside of this practice of undertaking commitments and justifying them. It's a kind of social status. But in that sense it can't be misrepresented in the same way that my body position can be misrepresented. From this we can conclude that subjective continuity is also a normative status conferred on rational systems by their involvement in this practice. So in playing this game of undertaking commitments and being called on to justify and act upon them, it's not just the commitments themselves that are normatively instituted statuses, it's the role of being the subject who has them as well. So the way I put it here is there's nothing more to being the same subject than being counted as that subject in accordance with certain socially instituted norms of individuation. What makes up the gap between the necessary and sufficient conditions is social. Another example of this kind of necessary arbitrariness is found in neutral language. I mean, one of the other conditions of the Salazian account put forward is that there's a fundamental link between thought and language, which means that a rational agent needs to have some kind of set of norms for understanding the relationships between sentences. They need to have some kind of language, but it's not determined which language they have to have. They don't have to have French or English or Mandarin or some kind of completely alien language that has yet to be constructed. but they nevertheless need to have some system of principle. And the idea that there needs to be some way of carving up people into units who can remain responsible for the same commitments over time is just a deeper structural part of that same practice. How much time have I got, by the way?
I think you have 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay, great. Now, the sort of methodological approach I'm putting forward here is quite different to that taken in most ordinary debates about personal identity. What you find in most debates is that people start by arguing about the metaphysics of person. They're interested in understanding what persons are, be they Cartesian egos, souls, or time slicers, or certain sets of like memory persistence relations or whatever, and then they use their arguments about those particular cases in order to justify positions in the ethical domain, so that to move to normative issues about when we should take people to be responsible for things. So, you can think of examples regarding amnesia. You know, is the amnesiac responsible for the horrible murders he commits? He or his body committed, you know, before he lost his memory. Things like this. Now, what I'm recommending is actually that there's nothing more to being a subject than being counted as responsible. That identity, that continuity of responsibility is the essence of subjectivity. So I think most of the ordinary debates are backwards. And it's not to say that all of the other stuff they argue about with regards to like psychological or biological criteria of identity are irrelevant, but it's rather the way they relate to this is different. They relate to it through the necessity of us having to have some deeper set of criteria regarding how we divide up those continuities of responsibility. But while they're searching for a single natural set of criteria, what I'm arguing is you just need to have some. You just need to have some criteria that works. That's what's required by the rational agency. However, there's a little family works here, insofar as I don't think it's quite as arbitrary as that might sound, because there are always going to be biological constraints regarding the way in which we as humans are actually constructed that affect what set of criteria we can make work. So just as there are important similarities between the languages which actually develop because they're based upon constraints regarding what kinds of information humans can actually process, right? There are going to be natural constraints upon the sorts of criteria regarding personhood that we develop. And that these are going to have a lot to do with the way in which we are functionally structured to track our own state. It's going to have a lot to do with the kinds of stuff that Metzinger thinks is tracked by, or rather, it's going to have a lot to do with Metzinger's phenomenal self model and what it tracks. So, what I'm trying to say here is that the individuation of ourselves as rational subjects is going to be to some extent dependent upon our mechanisms for generating phenomenal selves, or that there's a socially mediated functional relationship between what I've called the core reasoning system and what Metzinger calls the phenomenal self model. The domain of this social mediation is what you might call the political realm, wherein the massive information processing network of brains which we're part of divides itself up into loci of authority and responsibility before distributing specific authority and responsibilities between them. So I'm trying to sort of, this is where the final little political bit comes in. People have a tendency to think of the political sphere as what you get once you already have this group of individuals. It's about how we divide up the various different kinds of responsibility and authority between them. What I'm trying to argue is actually it also includes the very process of dividing up and deciding what counts as an individual in the first place. Right. There are a couple of sort of interesting consequences of this, which I'll just sort of briefly look at, and then we can turn to talking about it. So the crucial insight I've suggested is that politics doesn't just involve the division of responsibilities between pre-existing subjects, but also the very individuation of subjects up there. However, it also shows that this individuation does not operate without constraint. Nothing can be counted as a particular subject that does not have some capacity to track and act upon the specific commitments it's thereby responsible for. This is the basic form of the principle of ought implies can. One cannot have any responsibilities or corresponding rights unless one is capable of recognising and acting upon some responsibility. This abstract form of rational agency put it in this way. The mechanism independence of the rational schema, this abstract idea of the functional structure of rational agency, implies that it can be instantiated in whatever you like. Just like you can make a computer out of silicon, or you can make it out of biological matter, or you can make it out of an elaborate system of, you know, cats chasing mice and gates and cheese. I think you can make a rational agent out of anything. And this means there's no reason that this schema can't be applied recursively. There's no reason that you can't make rational agents function as parts of other rational agents operating at a larger scale. This is what I mean by collective agents. That's just what I think Hegel would call spirit. Now, this raises a whole variety of issues regarding how we individuate collective subjects. For example, how we count systems such as corporations or states as responsible for their actions. And how we construct effective agents. So how you can develop anything like a political will in acting as a group. But what I think is quite interesting is it provides an example of the way that rational consciousness and phenomenal consciousness pull apart, at least insofar as whatever minimal dynamic functional unity a collective subject's representational systems could be said to have, anything that could be said to be its phenomenal in a life would be very, very different from ours. Just to explain that point in slightly better language, the idea that you could organise a group of people in such a way that they'd be able to collectively track certain commitments that they're responsible for acting upon in the appropriate way to count as a group agent, right, shows just how different this notion of rational agency is from this kind of intuitive conception of phenomenal consciousness, insofar as although we can see that there might be able to be a subject there, anything that could be said to be a self in Metzinger's sense just doesn't seem to be there. We have no idea what it would be even to say that a collective subject had anything like an intersection in a life. The other three things I'd like to put forward is first of all, what I call the idea of overlapping subjectivity. The possibility that what I call the core reasoning system can externalise aspects of its function implies that these externalised elements could potentially be shared by multiple distinct rational agents. The more one considers the cognitive resources required to engage in most reasoning tasks, the more likely it seems that cognitive outsourcing and cognitive division of labour play an important part in the way we track our commitments and the inferential relationship between them. This suggests that we may be able to discover and analyse the functional structure of a whole range of what you might call socio-cognitive systems that are not yet collective agents, but which play an important role within constituting a variety of individual agents. There's also what I call fragmented subjectivity. The concerns we've been working on also raise the possibility that there could be systematic breakdowns of reliable tracking and action in relation to shifting external contexts. So, for instance, moving between different socio-cognitive networks and internal contexts. So, fractures within your rational subject model. The reliable dispositions that are constitutive agency can fragment, so you can act inconsistently across different contexts. And in doing so, this fragments the subjects to which they're correlated. The question is just how much fragmentation can be permitted before this disrupts the identification of a given causal system with a given subject. And that's a serious issue, and it forms part of the larger question regarding what criteria of subjective individuation we decide upon. This kind of fragmentation goes some way to providing a more subtle explanation for weakness of the will, for why we aren't always consistent in the actions we take with relevant relation to our beliefs. Finally, socially instituted norms for individuating subjects can't simply prescribe the way existing causal systems are individuated, but must prescribe the ways in which new causal systems are being cultivated so as to be sort of viable. This is ordinarily thought of as the political problem of socialisation, but it extends beyond the problem of the production and education of new generations of rational agents to the systems that are in place for maintaining and stabilising the reliable dispositions of agents that are already socialised. These are what Foucault would call systems of subjectivation. This extends the study of socio-cognitive systems that I discussed earlier to include external factors that play a role in sustaining the dynamic unity of the core reasoning system itself, rather than merely what it outsources. Sorry, those bits were a bit more dense than I should have known. That's it. Prediction, I don't mean I don't try to weight that word as being uncertain. I think you could have absolutely, or at least as good as certain predictions. We do have plenty of them, you know. If I knock this over, it's going to fall down. Perhaps a bad example, but there are better ones where we have really strong law-like generalisations in physics. Do I think psychology is ever going to have those same really strong law-like generalisations that physics does? No. I don't think that's the sort of model we should be looking at. But I, insofar as I don't think that, although we all belong to the same species, I don't think that generalisation, that general term human, is going to neatly fit into general laws like terms like mass. But I do think we can get really, really good at predicting individual behaviour. I don't see any reason why very, very detailed models of precisely how my neurological makeup or my neurological systems are working wouldn't give you a really, really damn good reason to think I was going to ask in certain ways. Is that
I'm not
again, I'm not advocating for like a from scratch thing. I'm just trying to say that a part of it is it's always good to make explicit what we were already doing, right? So we can, you don't have to give up what you were already doing in order to understand it better. And so the point I start saying is that, well, actually, we already have been dividing ourselves up into these located responsibilities. We've been doing it on the basis of these biological factors that at the time we didn't necessarily understand. Now we understand a lot better. It doesn't necessarily change the way we're doing things, but it does mean that if circumstances change and our existing norms for dealing with the individuation of subjects become awkward and need to be revised, we'll have a much better idea about how to go about doing so. So what I have in mind is these kind of like crazy sci-fi scenarios, which I think are entirely possible, where we become capable of getting up in the morning, copying myself in another five bodies, going out, you know, windsurfing and going to the library and doing all these various different things, and then coming back at my integrating one. I don't see any reason why that kind of thing isn't possible. What I see as the problem is how the hell does society function when personal identity isn't so easily tied to a particular continuity of organism. So basically what I'm sort of saying is that we have norms for individual subjects, but they haven't really been tested very well. And it's quite likely that they will end up being tested, and we'll have to recognise and take responsibility for making certain important decisions about who we count as who.
So basically, essentially, reason with a capital R becomes reason, like functional, instrumental. Because when you say it's a rational subject, it really means definitely not in a negative way. You're talking about rational in terms of how things work, how things function, so we can kind of harmony.
Well, I'm totally candid. I consider this to be a very candid account. I mean, one of the when I say that, when I open this up by saying the reason you can tie these two things together is because they're both functional. It's important to remember that basically Kant is a functional. When Kant's talking about faculties, right? Instead of reading that as some kind of weird account of empirical psychology, think of it as information processing systems. Kant distinguishes the different faculties on the basis of the kinds of representation they deal with, which just means the types of information that they're dealing with. What Kant's doing when he's doing transcendental psychology isn't bad empirical psychology. It's an attempt to do something like artificial intelligence. It's an attempt to do something like provide a completely abstract account of what something would have to be able to do in order to count as a rational agent. There are some kind of awkward aspects of that reading, but I stand by it.
There's also something about the rational aim of the claim. You're just talking about, and that can't, it's not kind of imperative, it's not reason, it's like talking about it's a functional.
Well, but Kant is all about reason, right? This is one of the interesting things about Kant. The whole of Kant's philosophy, or at least his transcendental psychology, begins from the idea that the kind of fundamental unit of thought is the judgment, right? Which is very different from both the empiricists and a lot of the rationalists that came before him, insofar as they would always start with terms. They'd always start with like concepts or sensations or ideas, right? Things which are supposed to kind of come together to constitute what we form difference, right? When I'm talking about sentences, that's all I mean. That's all I think Kant means, basically, when he's talking about judgments. Things that can stand as reasons, and that can have other judgments stand as reasons for them.
Yes, but you mentioned the mathematical human understanding and human mathematical identity somehow fundamentally kind of flawed?
If I'm getting it right, So I just present a kind of like really, really quick reading of Kant last year. Basically what Kant was doing is artificial intelligence 2 years ago. Right? And if you accept that, you don't have to, but if you accept that, and you go, well, how did Hegel build on Kant? Well, my account of how Hegel built on Kant is that he recognised that Kant's account of the mind was so abstract that it could apply to groups of people. You could talk about genuine collective agents. And you go, well, how has that developed? And you go, well, what about Marx? You can see a trajectory in the development of that kind of thought when you start talking about things like collective consciousness. I think there's a lot of bad stuff been done with the notion of class consciousness, but I think there's definitely something in there that can be fed into this sort of story. Kinds of economic circumstances, they are sensitive to each other's actions, And that sensitivity constitutes kind of information channels out of which you can create this kind of like parallel processing system through which niches emerge, you know. So by being born of a certain class, you are cultivated into certain ways of doing things, certain ways of solving practical problems that people from other classes won't necessarily be aware of. That's what I see. And I think that's what you might want to think of as a kind of like a level of implicit consciousness that is yet to become explicit. It's yet to become an attempt to sort of, to put it in slightly more Marxist terms, right? They're tied together by their interests, not because they have some collective conception of their interests as a group, but because all of their interests as individuals are close enough to each other to constitute some kind of socio-cognitive system. Something like self-consciousness would emerge when you move to the point where they become aware of their interests as a group and become able to act not just through this kind of implicit information processing which benefits them, but in terms of explicit.
Well, I was just kind of like, I might just mess it up like properly, and you know, but I was just interested in something you said quite early on, which was to do with explanatory and causal, causal schema and explanatory kind of like, would you just like explanations of certain happenings or whatever.
Yeah.
So, what would, what, how's the, what's the differentiation between the two? Is there not, like the explanatory model, would that not involve objects as well? Would there not be any causality between the objectivity of the object?
Yeah, I mean, just all I was trying to say was there's an important sense in which everything is the same, right? Insofar as everything is causal, everything is open to causal interaction with everything else. That's just kind of a basic metaphysical commitment I have, but it's a fairly common metaphysical commitment. What I was trying to do was to show how that can be commensurate with the idea that there's something that distinguishes humans or rational agents from everything else. Because one of the traditionally philosophical is like, think Descartes, right? Descartes is like the principal example of this as well. Look, thought's just a different kind of substance. Right? In order to understand how we are different from everything else in the world, we're just gonna say it's just a completely different kind of thing. And then you end up with the problem of, well, how does thought interact with extension? How does do our minds, which is supposed to be completely radically unextended and entirely different, interact with our bodies so as to actually interact with the things that we understand in terms of mathematics and science and other things like that. What I was trying to sort of say is you can account for the sort of intuition that drives people to make those kinds of really heavy-handed metaphysical or logical distinctions in terms of explanation and forms of explanation rather than ontological different categories of being. What I want to say is that what's kind of peculiar about thinking beings are rational agents is that we have to explain their behaviour in a certain kind of way. Does that make sense?
Well, you know, it's a bit personal kind of, but yeah, you kind of like put it in a context somewhere, and yeah, thanks.
It is about that relationship between causes and reasons. And I don't
And I didn't quite, I think you maybe go what you just said again, because it seemed like you were trying to suggest that there wasn't an ontological difference between causes and reasons. It's just something about
that's certainly not what I was trying to say. I mean,
yeah, because that would be another next question in terms of how, if you are going to solve it, well, I'll let you say that in a minute, if you are going to solve it, some sort of radical difference between causes and reasons, well, does that mean you're no longer an ontological univocalist or whatever the word is? I mean, are you any longer a believer in the university of being?
Okay.
Because I have another question about that.
No, it's a really good point. First of all, right, let's recognise that sort of reason and cause are fundamentally, like, their concepts are fundamentally tied together. But they are sort of two different sides of the same complex, an epistemological and a metaphysical side. Right? The notion of a reason is fundamentally an epistemological notion, whereas cause is fundamentally metaphysical. Even though we kind of, in a lot of sort of loose language, we can say, well, you know, okay, why did that happen? We say, well, that's the reason. Right? We point to, like, the, you know, the one billion ball that strikes you using the horrible human example and say that's really important, the reason why that blue ball over there. That's a, I think, just a kind of a loose way of thinking. Really, what kind of reasons are judgments or facts or assertions? Reasons are insofar as reasons are in the world, it's as representation of the state of affairs rather than the state of affairs. Now, the thing about ontological university still kind of comes insofar as. So, the rough structure of the talk, I tried to kind of give half of it badly, was to sort of put forward Metzinger's thesis, there are no cells, cells do not exist, right? And then to contrast it with the kind of Salazian thesis that says, well, actually, there are subjects. The really problematic thing for me is, well, wait a minute, what do you mean by there are there? Like, what kind of existence are you describing to subjects? Because surely I've just said that subjects are things that are socially instituted. They're things that they're a kind of normative status that is applied to causal systems. They are causal systems themselves. So how am I supposed to make that compatible with my claim that, well, really the only things that exist are causal systems? There's a kind of a whole bunch of complicated machinery that I like to bring in at this point. But the basic answer to that is, there's also a sense in which I think subjects don't exist, which is related to the sense in which I think Harry Potter doesn't exist. Right? Harry Potter doesn't exist, nor does his best friend. But it's true that Harry Potter has a best friend. Right? If it's true that Harry Potter has a best friend, surely that implies that there is something that we're able to quantify over. That is Harry Potter. So we have ways of talking about objects that, strictly speaking, don't exist. The difference between Harry Potter and various fictional entities and subjects is that Harry Potter is strictly optional. The kind of language game of talking about fictional entities is a completely optional one. If we didn't talk about fictional entities, we wouldn't have any problems with anything else. What I'm saying with regard to the subject is that that's not the case. Right? It's a kind of sort of transcendental fiction. Right? We simply have to talk about subjects. And what I've tried to sort of say is there's no single one right way that we are transcendentally required to talk about. But we do have to have some kind of language game
for quantifying another subject, right, in order to have everything else. It's a necessary fiction. Well, I feel much more like fiction now. Does that make some kind of sense?
Yes, sir.
So the whole thing about, I give a whole other paper on what it is to say that things exist as opposed to say that they really exist.
Thank you.